local. We are Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game, KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parch III talks sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. LSU All-American Skylar Green.
You know, as a young athlete growing up, you always want to do the game-winning something, the game-winning shot, game-winning catch. And I thought the biggest part for me right there, that Georgia catch, that solidifying everybody seeing that LSU for real.
Ridge and Cajun hoop star Elfrid Payton.
It's exciting to be able to represent, you know, your city, you know, somewhere where you grew up at and put that jersey on, see that says New Orleans on the front of it. I think it means a lot.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Good morning. This is RP3 and Company. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III, and you're listening to Acadiana Sports Station 103.7 The Game. We appreciate you making us part of your morning. Be safe out there on your commute to work and school. We are broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. We're also simulcast on Stadium Network 32.1. That's free over-the-air 24-hour sports coverage. And you can also find us on LUS Fiber 133 and 1133 in high definition. We've got a jam-packed edition of today's show lined up for you. We have New York Times best-selling author Lars Anderson will be joining us. He has a new book out on the shelves, Chasing the Bear, how Bear Bryant and Nick Saban. It's all about those two icons of the game. He'll join us at 8:32. We'll talk all things college football, his insight on week one now in the books, who impressed him, who did impress him, the one and only from Saturday down south, Connor O'Gara, will join us. We'll also have the voice of the LSU Tigers, Chris Blair. I'm sure he'll be enthusiastic about what he saw from the Tigers in week one against Georgia Southern and help us preview their game at Texas on Saturday. And then we'll also go behind enemy lines. We tried to set it up yesterday. We couldn't get it done, but we got it done this morning for you. Damon Sordelet, he covers the Liberty Flames. He's going to give us the behind the enemy lines viewpoint on UL's opponent this Saturday, plus Houston Astros, and much, much more. But I want to start things off talking a little LSU football. That's right. Ed O had his presser yesterday. Holiday pushed it back a day, but he's pushed it back till Tuesday. So he addressed the media yesterday during his press conference. Talked about a plethora of different things, how his team performed in the opener against Georgia Southern, what players were held out, who's coming back, so forth and so forth. But he also focused in on the opponent this week. It's a battle of top 10 teams, number 6 LSU at number 9 Texas. It's the marquee matchup. College game day is going to be in Austin for the game. It's a historic matchup. It hasn't happened. That's the bizarre thing about this LSU-Texas game, how two teams this close to each other, neighboring states, haven't played more. It just never happened for whatever reason. Well, it's happening on Saturday, and the excitement level is quite high on this game. It's the national game of the week. It's the one that everyone is going to be tuning in for on primetime television. You can also listen to the game live right here on 103.7 The Game. Pre-game starts at 4:30 on Saturday. Kickoff 6:30 right here on the game. Coach O, though, dissected Texas. This is what he had to say about the star quarterback for the Longhorns.
The offense is led by Sam Ellinger, quarterback. He's a very, very good football player. He's a complete football player, and he does a lot of things with his feet. He does a great job with his arm. He makes some great decisions. They have an excellent scheme. They're very similar to us on offense. And he knows where to go with the football.
First of all, are there any players that Coach O doesn't think is good football players? Because whether it's the opponent or his own, Coach O's go-to is, Well, he's a good football player. Everyone is a good football player for Coach O. I love it. What does Sam bring to the table? He is not as dynamic of as a passer as the one LSU has on its roster. He's more of a runner. Now, they're not going to run this triple option by any stretch of the imagination. That's not how they operate their offense. This is a Tom Herman-coached offense. Expect more up-tempo. But Sam is dynamic. He's an athletic quarterback. But is he Vince Young? No. He is not. I'll go ahead and tell you now. Nope, he's not. Vince Young was special. Vince Young was the type of guy that you see and you're like, wow. When you watched him play, you're like, wow. I don't get that when I watch Sam. I get a guy who's still trying to learn how to be a complete quarterback. And at this part of the process, probably should be a little bit more complete of a quarterback. Not to say that he can't make plays with his arm. He can. Not to say that he can't make clutch plays. Not saying that at all. But once again, I said it on yesterday's show, people keep trying to make Texas be, they so desperately want the Longhorns to be what they used to be that, you know, we're drawing these comparisons. Well, Sam broke a record or tied a record held by Vince Young. That must mean he's as good as Vince Young. Nope. Stop. That's not what that means. Stop, stop, stop. But he is a dual-threat quarterback, and Dave Aranda will have to game plan for that. Coach O, meanwhile, also talked about the rest of the Longhorns' offense in addition to their quarterback.
Keontae Ingram's a big back. He's physical and he's explosive. Kyle Joseph may be the biggest and one of the best receivers we see all year. We're going to have a plan for them. They're very strong up front, have a very good scheme.
Strong up front, going to have to deal with that scheme. Now, Coach O was also talked about a little bit more about the Texas quarterback. And he told the media yesterday who Sam reminds him of. Who when he watches him play, when he watches the tape of the Texas Longhorn starting quarterback, who does he see?
You know, he reminds me a little bit of Tebow. And I was at another school and we had to play Tebow. And I'm not saying he's as good as Tebow. I'm not saying he's not, but he reminds me of that type of player, but he's a better thrower.
So that's not a bad comparison at all. That's actually pretty spot on from Coach O. He reminds him of Tebow, but a better passer. Now, Tebow is one of the best college players I've ever seen. We can knock him all we want for the fact that he flamed out as a starting quarterback in the NFL. He joins a long list of guys who have done just that. He joins a long list of guys who have done just that that played quarterback in college. And he also joins a very long list of Heisman Trophy winning quarterbacks that have flamed out in the NFL. Okay? But, once again, Tebow didn't have the prettiest throwing motion. He's a lefty. Traditionally, they do not. Something about the spiral of the ball does not leave their hand as well as it would if you were a right-handed quarterback. Tebow won a Heisman as a sophomore, first to do it. Won two national championships. One of the guttiest, most competitive people that have ever played the game. But Tebow made big plays when it mattered the most. And even though O may look at him and say, he kind of reminds me of Tebow, but with a better arm, that's great. Tebow made a slew of plays. LSU fans remember the jump pass. Big moments Tebow delivered. That's what made him such a legendary performer at the collegiate level. Is Sam that? Is Sam that? I don't know. And we'll get a good idea just how good this kid is when he faces off against one of the top defenses in the country on Saturday. How's Coach O in his defense going to possibly defend the dynamic UT quarterback? Well, this is what he had to say yesterday.
Yeah, you know, that stuff sounds good until they start giving it to the running back and they start making a lot of plays, you know. So we're going to have a sound defensive scheme. The one thing I like about Coach Aranda and our defensive staff, we may have gone into last week's game with about 15 different defenses. We used one. Our guys play. And, you know, we're going to go in there and play our base defense. Now, if we need to make adjustments as the game goes on, Coach Aranda always has some answer. So I'm sure there'll be something like that if we need it. But if we can play our base defense and play the things that we play well, that's what we're always going to do that.
It's interesting that he says that. They had multiple defensive game plans developed, written up, worked on, ready to go. They only used one. Now, they only had to use one because the one that they started off the game with was so damn effective it kept Georgia Southern, a dangerous triple option team, to less than 100 yards of offense. Here's what I'll say once again. There's a big difference between, for Texas, between, say, facing the best team that they faced last year. The two best teams they faced last year, they faced Oklahoma and Georgia. They beat them both. That's why they're ranked in the top 10 this year. Okay? That's exactly why they're ranked in the top 10 this year. Because of two games. Not because of their body of work last year, but because of two games that they had. Two. They had two very impressive wins. But this is a team last year that I'll remind everyone, yes, they won the Sugar Bowl. Okay? Yes, they played for the Big 12 championship, lost to Oklahoma, and in the Sugar Bowl, they beat Georgia. And they finished number 9 in the final AP poll. They run a dangerous spread offense, all that good jazz. They did all of that. And they beat Oklahoma during the regular season. And they played for the Big 12 championship. And they beat Georgia in the Sugar Bowl. All these things are correct. This is also a team that lost to Oklahoma State. This is also a team that opened up the season losing to a bad Maryland team who fired their head coach later in the year. This is a team that barely got by Tulsa. Tulsa. This is a team that barely got by Kansas State. This is a team that barely got by a bad Baylor team. So we can cherry pick and look at, well, hey, they had two really good wins. That's what we're going to focus on. This is a 4-loss team from a year ago that struggled to beat Tulsa, that lost to a bad Maryland team, that lost to a mediocre Oklahoma State team, and ended the year defeating a very disinterested Georgia team. Once again, I was there for the Sugar Bowl, not taking anything away from it. But the hype train has been just going all out, full on, dumping buckets and buckets of coal into this locomotive ever since the offseason began. Sam, the quarterback, and that offense have not faced a defense like they're going to face on Saturday. They just haven't. Not Georgia with a disinterested Georgia team that had their best cornerback out because he was declared for the draft. Not Oklahoma. I'm sorry, Big 12 does not play defense. Okay. They haven't faced a defense like this. They haven't faced off against cornerbacks like Christian Fulton, like a young Derek Stingley. They have not faced off with Grant Delpit. Okay. They haven't faced off against Rashard Lawrence or anybody else on that defense. As good as Texas is, and as impressive as they were able to overcome the first half of their season last year where they struggled against bad teams and lost to a bad Maryland team, and were able to turn things around after that Oklahoma win and ended the season with a win in the Sugar Bowl, they didn't face anyone to the caliber of LSU. And I'll say it again. Yes, they beat Georgia last year by a touchdown, 28-21 in the Sugar Bowl. Georgia was disinterested, did not want to be there, and Texas still only won by 7. And by the way, LSU absolutely embarrassed Georgia last season, if you remember. If you're telling me that these two teams, with the people that they have, the personnel that they have on the field, that they're on equal footing, Not buying it. Not buying it. I saw both of those games in person. I saw LSU curb stomp Georgia, and I saw Texas push around Georgia. It was there for both of them, start to finish. LSU on a different level than what Texas is. We can keep hyping this game up all we want. But I'm telling you, don't be surprised if this is a lopsided affair come Saturday. We're going to continue the LSU-UT discussion after this quick timeout. You're listening to RP3 and Company right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. I am your host, Raymond Parch III, and we are broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. We're also simulcast on Stadium Network 32.1. You can also find us on LUS Fiber 133 and 1133 in high definition. Started off today talking about LSU versus UT. Coach O had his presser yesterday. Talked a lot about how they're going to game plan for Sam Engler. He is the starting quarterback for the Texas Longhorns, and about the rest of the Texas offense. Coach O said he reminds him a little bit of Tim Tebow. Well, now we're going to talk a little bit about Texas's defense and LSU's defense. This is what Coach O had to say about what the Longhorns bring to the table on that side of the ball.
On defense, they're 3-3-5. They're returning four starters. Their linebackers are very, very good, and so is Caden Stearns, one of the best safeties we're going to see. Joseph Usai's number 46, is an excellent linebacker. Those guys can run and hit. They blitz a whole bunch, a zone blitz football team. They're very good at blitzing.
Very good at blitzing. Now, they do have a pretty good defense. They have a good defensive coordinator, Todd Orlando. Actually was recommended for the job by, wait for it, Dave Aranda, LSU's defensive coordinator. They know each other. They have an immense amount of respect for each other. So Coach O talked about facing off against Todd Orlando.
He disguises his blitzes. These guys know what they're doing. They're good tacklers. They use their speed. I think their strength of their defenses and their linebackers and their DBs, they use them a bunch.
Use them a bunch. So that's where I think you're going to see the biggest challenge for LSU. Offensive line looked good against Georgia Southern. But there's a big difference between Georgia Southern out of the Sun Belt and the Longhorns out of the Big 12. And Texas has got some hosses on that side of the ball. Now, that was the bugaboo for LSU all of last year, remember? They allowed too many hits on their quarterback. They allowed their quarterback to be pressured too much, and that forced them to become sometimes one-dimensional on offense because they couldn't have enough time to let the play develop. So that'll be a big key in this matchup on Saturday. Talking about linebackers and guys that can blitz, Michael Divinity. He was held out of Saturday's opener. This is what Coach O talked about, working him back into the rotation at linebacker, a guy in the spring they viewed as a leader of this team.
We're going to go through the week and see what happens. You know, obviously, we're going to work Michael back in. We think Michael's an excellent linebacker for us and also can play out the line of scrimmage sometimes when we need him. We're going to see how we can work those guys in, what maybe a first down situation with somebody else, a third down situation with somebody else, and play all four of them in equal snaps. They deserve it.
So he's going to work him back into probably some type of undisclosed disciplinary reason. That's also Sadiq Charles was also held out of Saturday's opener for undisclosed reasons, the tackle on the offense side of the ball. Chaisson, we talked about him. Remember last year he tore up his knee in the opener against Miami. He was already being an absolute fiend in that game at AT&T Stadium. Gets hurt, has to miss the whole year. Comes back, he gets to rock the number 18 this year, leader of the defense. This is what Coach O had to say about Chaisson.
Well, you know, he's gained some weight, obviously. Kelemon is very thick, and he has a great lower body. He has a lot of strength in his lower body, and he's worked hard. And, you know, this injury, allowed him to get strong in the weight room. Tommy Moffitt has done a tremendous job with this guy. He's very explosive. As you can see, he's all muscles. And the way he played last Saturday night is how we expect him to play.
So how he performed last Saturday night is how they expect him to play moving forward. Look, we talked a lot about how this team, their mindset is different, the LSU team is. Last year they had to deal with some immaturity. They had off-the-field arrests, some of them more serious, just not being immature, some of them being quite fiendish. Okay, let's be perfectly blunt there. They had to deal with some disruption and a lot of outside noise. They were able to overcome that, get their act together, gel as a team, win 10 games, win the PlayStation Fiesta Bowl. This year, you haven't heard anything off the field. They've been more focused, more disciplined, and he talked about that maturity that his team has this year.
We're about to tell on Saturday night, and I do expect them to play well. This is a mature team. The way they acted yesterday were not giddy. It was a day off for them. We had Tell the Truth Monday. They handled the film very well. We had one of our best Monday practices we ever had. They know the magnitude of this football game, but again, we're not going to make it bigger than life. We've been in big games before, but this is a big game, and they know it.
This is a big game, and they know it. I think his team is better prepared for a game like this. And look, they showed great maturity last year when they welcomed number 2 Georgia to town. Okay? They've been in these big games before, but this team is a little bit more mature, a little bit more veteran leadership this year than they were last year. And that's saying something when you lost Devin White off of your team. We got to take a timeout. You're listening to RP3 and Company right here on the Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III, and you're listening to Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Astros, despite the efforts of Alex Bregman, fall yesterday 4-2 to the Milwaukee Brewers. They split that little two-game road series with the Brewers. They took game one. They lost game two last night. Bregman had his home run and had himself a heck of a game. Scary moment, though, in the game involving Astros all-star center fielder George Springer, Springer Dinger, who had to be carted off the field last night after violently slamming his head against the wall in the fifth inning of Tuesday night's game. He backpedaled to draw a bead on Ryan Braum's two-out fly ball. He leapt and made the catch on the warning track, but he landed awkwardly on his back leg. Then he tumbled backward into the padding and fell into the dirt, immediately grabbing the back of his head. Now, Astros head trainer Jeremiah Randall and skipper A.J. Hinch rushed to his aid. The 29-year-old star remained on the ground for about a minute before slowly sitting up. Helped him to his feet, and he was cleared, but it was clear he could not walk off the field on his own accord. So they had to cart him off. He was in a daze. Speculation is that he possibly has a concussion. Remember, Springer suffered a concussion back in 2015. Top prospect Kyle Tucker had to replace him, and we'll keep you abreast of any developments there with George Springer. If he does, in fact, have a concussion, they'll obviously run all types of tests there and figure out exactly what's going on with the Houston Astros star center fielder. And it was a bang-bang play, too. I mean, he makes the play. He makes those plays all the time out there. But it was the way he kind of came down awkwardly, and then it's the way he fell down. And you watching it live, and you're like, uh-oh. You're like, that's not good. And when he got up, and you could just tell he had that look. He looked like, to me, I'm not a doctor. I am not a brain surgeon by any stretch of the imagination. I have trouble barely getting dressed in the morning. But it sure did look like to me that Springer appeared to have a concussion. And remember, the day before, Springer's home run decided that game in extras, the one that the Astros won 3-2. So they fall 4-2 last night. And they didn't have a bad day at the plate. You know, six hits is not great by any stretch of the imagination. You know, Brantley had an 0-for on there. Kyle Tucker, who came in for Springer, was 0-for-2. Bregman had a good game, 2-for-4. He continues to put himself in the MVP conversation. Mike Trout's winning the award, but Alex Bregman, the former LSU star, continues to put himself at least in the conversation of probably finishing as a top three candidate in the American League MVP race. But it was pretty much Bregs and no one else. Reddick had a hit. Zach Greinke, he had a hit. He was your starting pitcher. Never a good sign when one of your few handful of hits is from your pitcher. Greinke himself got roughed up yesterday. He only struck out 4. He lasted 6 innings, gave up 4 earned runs on 8 hits. So he falls. The Astros fall 90-50. Still on a torrid pace. The Brewers are fighting for, obviously, their playoff lives, trying to become a wild card team there in the National League. Little interesting two-game set is now behind them, though. Weird September two-game set against the Brewers. But they'll be back in action. They'll be off tonight. No Astros today. But they'll be back at home on Thursday, beginning a series with AL West opponent, the Seattle Mariners. You can listen to that game pregame 6:35, first pitch 7:10. You can listen to that game on our sister station, The Rewind, KVOL, 97.7 FM, 1330 AM. That'll be on Thursday. Astros will return to action then. Astros will be on our sister station on Thursday, and then, of course, on Saturday as well for that series. The start of the NFL football season is on Thursday. Packers at Bears. By the way, you can listen to that game live right here on 103.7 The Game, courtesy of Westwood One. Packers at Bears, pregame 6:30, kickoff shortly after 7 o'clock. So, Astros, even though they lost, they will continue to keep rolling right along. The Mariners are bad. I'd expect them to just get after the poor Mariners. Remember when the Mariners were good? Everyone was really high on them back in April. They're like, look, great start for the season for the Seattle Mariners. Yay! And by the middle of May, they were in last place. Okay? They are not good. They are not good. But the Astros will get back to action on Thursday. They're still the 90-win team. And look, if you look, sometimes we overdo it when we look at a game like this. Baseball is a very long season. There's a reason why in baseball they play 7-game series in the postseason. It's not determined by one game, ever. But if you look at your current standings right now, the Astros are only a game back of the Yankees for the best record in baseball. Actually, a half game. Yankees are 91-49. They look like they had the AL East locked up. The Tampa Bay, don't call me Devil Rays, are behind them. The Twins, looking like they are pulling away with the AL Central title. And the Houston Astros have all but locked up the AL West title as the Athletics are beginning to fade. They have a 9.5 game lead on the Athletics in the AL West standings. That matches the lead in the division standings that the Yankees have over the Rays. So this is going to be one of your best teams. Now, I do wonder if it is important for the Astros to have home field advantage. You know, if it comes down between them and the Yankees and the ALCS, does it matter? I don't think it matters to this team. I mean, I think it matters to the fans. You would much rather have four of the seven games in a seven-game set in the ALCS, being there at the big juice box. But I don't think the players care. I, for one, think they like the challenge of being on the road. I think they like the challenge of having to go into Yankee Stadium and win games there and win a series there to punch their ticket to the World Series. And the reason why I feel like they have that confidence, because of the lineup that they have, for one, they can hit anywhere. The other thing is they have the pitching staff. To win on the road in the postseason, you need to have the aces. You need to have the pitching staff. That's how it gets done. Remember, that's how the Diamondbacks beat the Yankees in the World Series, because the Diamondbacks had Curt Schilling and Randy Johnson. The Yankees did not. You have two aces. You can win on the road in the postseason. The Astros have three. So no matter how the rotation sets for a seven-game series, they will have the advantage, and they have the advantage over the Yankees when it comes to pitching regardless. So even though it may be a sense of pride for Houston Astros fans to be like, we want the best record in the American League, we want to be able to have home field advantage, I don't think it matters to the Astros themselves. I don't think it matters to skipper A.J. Hinch, and I don't think it matters to those guys on that roster. I just don't. I think they look at it as a challenge. I think that gives them a little bit of an edge. Really do. Once again, in the American League, your division leaders, Astros, 9.5 games up on the Oakland Athletics. The Yankees lead the East. They're 9.5 games up on the Rays. And Minnesota is leading the Central, the Twinkies, and they lead by 6.5 games. And then there is an absolute dogfight for those two wild card spots. And that's what interests me. Tampa Bay right now is leading. They have a one-game lead in the wild card standings in the American League. Oakland's right behind them, and Cleveland and Oakland are tied for that second spot. Do either of those teams scare you if you're a Houston Astros fan? Oakland's like, they just never go away. They're a pest. They're a gnat, right? Cleveland, though, has experience. Cleveland has getting to the World Series type of experience, and Cleveland is very familiar with Houston. Even though they won't have to worry about that, I don't know. That could be a team that could make some noise. Of those three teams, even though Tampa has some really excellent pitching, out of the Rays, the A's, and the Indians, the team, if I'm in the American League postseason, the team that I do not want to see is the Indians. They have a great skipper in Terry Francona, who's won World Series championships. Majority of this Indians roster has already been to a World Series. They fell short, of course, against the Cubs a few years ago, but they know how to win in the postseason. Terry Francona knows how to win in the postseason. If the Indians get in as one of the wild card teams, they would represent, to me, they would be the most dangerous team in the American League. Postseason, a threat to either the Yankees or the Astros, because you can never discount a team with experience and a great manager. A great manager can win you a series in the postseason. A great manager can also, well, a bad manager can also lose you a series in the postseason. See Dusty Baker at any one of his stops. So, yeah, coming down the stretch here, it's going to be Tampa Bay, Oakland, Cleveland battling it out for those two wild card spots. Division titles should be locked up. Astros, Yankees, Twins. Once again, Astros get back to action on Thursday versus the Seattle Mariners at Minute Maid Ballpark. Astro launch will begin at 6:35. First pitch, 7:10. You can listen to that game once again on our sister station, KVOL. That's the Rewind, 97.7 FM, 13:30 AM. We got to take a quick timeout. We'll wrap up hour number one of RP3 and Company. You're listening to Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. I'm your host, Raymond Parts III, and we are broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. We're also simulcast on Stadium Network 32.1. You can also find us on LUS Fiber 133 and 1133 in high definition. Trolling. It is an art form, isn't it? And in the sports world, it can be quite entertaining. I'm going to tell you, if you haven't seen this, I want to tell you a little bit about some troll jobs that I've seen over the last couple days. And it's related to, of course, college football. And some of the troll work, whoo, has been impressive so far. We're only really a week into the season, and I've already seen some next-level award-winning trolling going on out there. I want to start off with the first thing that caught my attention. So, apparently, there was a truck, and there's video of this, a truck that was driving around downtown Atlanta yesterday, just driving around, and it was able to have a projection screen on the side of it. And what it did, it kept showing a loop of highlights of Georgia State beating Tennessee on Saturday. And on the back of the truck, it just has the final score projected on there. But on the side of the truck was just highlights of Georgia State beating up on the poor Volunteers of Tennessee there in Knoxville. Which, by the way, reminder, not only did Georgia State, a two-win team a year ago out of the Sun Belt, go into Knoxville, defeat the SEC's Tennessee Volunteers at their place, Tennessee paid them $950,000 to do so. They left with a victory and a check for nearly $1 million. And someone, not even affiliated with the university, someone had enough money and enough time to go, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get me a big truck. I'm going to have a projection screen on the outside of it to show highlights of Georgia State beating Tennessee. I mean, now Georgia State may not win another game this year. That tells you the state of Tennessee Volunteers football right now. But just wow. Just wow. I mean, that takes dedication. You realize how much money that probably took? Does he own the truck? I have questions. I don't know. The video that has been provided to us is someone in their car rolling up at a stoplight, at a stop sign, and seeing this truck and just taking a picture of it. In addition to that, we'll stay with Georgia State in their trolling. The actual athletic department has trolled as well. Shortly after winning the game, Georgia State sent out season ticket holders and to their alumni and to everyone else a Labor Day ticket package sale. And you're like, well, that's nice. How are you going to build off some momentum? Hey, we just beat Tennessee, right? This is a good thing. Well, the graphic that they came up with, well-designed, vibrant blue colors and white colors, Labor Day 24-hour sale, a ticket package for $38.30. Promo code LABOR. Of course, the final score was 38-30. So on the actual Labor Day ticket package sale for Georgia State that their athletic department, their ticket office sent out, it says hashtag upset. The U is in orange. So is the T to represent Tennessee. And the price of the ticket package for four tickets is $38.30. Just good job, Georgia State fans. And good job, Georgia State. I mean, this is your moment in the sun. Now, I also want to touch on some other trolling that's been going on. Caused a little bit of a buzz on social media. There's a picture of UT players, Texas players, wearing shirts that said DBU on the back of them. We've heard LSU push back on that. Well, Zippy's Burritos, Tacos, and More in Baton Rouge took offense to that. They posted up on their marquee outside of their restaurant, "If Texas is DBU, then we're Ruth's Steakhouse." Bravo. Just bravo. Bravo. I love mid-season form on the troll job for college football. We got to take a timeout when we come back. Davion Sortolet will join us, help us preview Liberty at UL.
It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parch III talks sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. Former LSU National Championship coach Les Miles.
So when I took the field, I was ecstatic that crowd was just happy as they could be with these Tigers.
CFL Most Outstanding Player and Grey Cup Champion Kerry Joseph.
You know, growing up as a kid in New Iberia, it was just about playing sports. You never knew where it was going to take you. You have a desire, you have a dream, you have a passion for it. Just to be where I am today, it's something that I would have never thought.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Good morning. Welcome back to RP3 and Company right here on Acadiana Sports Station 103.7 The Game. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III, and I appreciate you making us part of your morning. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. We're also simulcast on Stadium Network 32.1. That's free over-the-air 24-hour sports coverage. And you can also find us on LUS Fiber 133 and 1133 in high definition. We spent the majority of yesterday's programming talking about the UL Raging Cajuns. Our thoughts on how they performed in the season opener versus Mississippi State and looking ahead about their next opponent. Their home opener is this Saturday at Cajun Field, 6:30 kick, and they're hosting the Liberty Flames, coached by Hugh Freeze, former Ole Miss head coach, the man who was able to beat Nick Saban a few times when he was with the Rebels. To get a better perspective, more in-depth perspective on UL's opponent this Saturday is a man who covers the team better than anyone else. He covers Liberty University Athletics for the News and Advance there in Lynchburg, Virginia. He's also a AP Top 25 Men's College Basketball voter. He joins us now courtesy of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. It is Damian Sortolet. Damian, how you doing this morning, brother?
I'm doing well this morning, Raymond. Thank you for having me on.
Appreciate you making out the time for us. I'm assuming you're getting plenty of phone calls and requests from the 318 and the 337 and the 504 area codes this time of year because of the matchup that's going on this Saturday. Let's get right to that. What can we expect to see offensively from the Flames when they come to Cajun Field this Saturday? We know Hugh Freeze is all about up-tempo, high-powered offenses. Is that what we can expect to see from the Flames this Saturday?
Yeah, I think you'll expect to see a little bit more tempo than what Liberty showed against Syracuse in that game. Neither team reached the 80-play mark, and that was by design for Liberty to prevent Syracuse from being on the field as much and wearing down Liberty's defense. But, Freeze Monday during his press conference said he hadn't been a part of an offense that was as inept as Liberty's was against Syracuse, minus 4 yards rushing. And when you're not able to run the ball effectively, the Orange were able to, bring pressure, oftentimes disguising the pressure and ended up only bringing three or four, but having effective pressure. And that meant more players in coverage. And it was hard for quarterback Buckshot Calvert to be able to find some passing lanes, especially when Antonio Gandy-Golden, his 6'4", 220-pound target on the outside, was blanketed by Andre Sisco, who was playing over the top in safety help. But I'm expecting Liberty will try to find a way to get the running game going. Frankie Hickson and Peyton Pickett weren't able to get going against Syracuse. And normally when they're able to get going in the run game and you're able to run them between the tackles, 6-7 yards a pop, that really opens things up in the passing game. And I expect Liberty will make a concerted effort to get the running game going and an effort to maintain possession, because that defense played really well against Syracuse, but those players on that side of the ball played a lot of snaps as well. Even though there was only 79 offensive snaps for Syracuse, a lot of the key players for Liberty were on the field for most of those snaps. So, try to play keep away, because Louisiana could play keep away as well on offense with that three-headed running attack and being able to churn out some yards and eat up some clock.
We're talking with Damian Sortolet of the News and Advance there in Lynchburg, Virginia. He covers the Liberty Flames for that publication. He joins us courtesy of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. Damian, tell me a little bit more about this wide receiver I keep hearing about. I did a little research. He had more than 1,000 yards last year. He had double-digit touchdowns. He was an absolute beast, and he went off against Syracuse defense, a top 25 team, this past week. What can you tell us more about the big playmaker there for the Flames?
Yeah, Antonio Gandy-Golden has been a consistent threat on the outside for Liberty the past 2 years. He's had more than 1,000 yards receiving each of the past 2 years, and he's moving up the program record books. He's now number 4 all-time in both receptions and receiving yards, and if he keeps up this pace, he will probably break both records by the time he's set to graduate. You know, he was born in Chicago, didn't play football until his mother moved him and his brothers to Dallas, Georgia, a suburb outside of Atlanta. And that was about, you know, high school when he finally got into football. But his prior background is in gymnastics. He's one of the few players on the football team who can do a standing backflip. He's freakishly athletic, runs in between a 4.45 and a 4.5 40. Really long arms, the ability to break tackles. There was a 56-yard catch and run against Syracuse where he caught it, you know, on a hitch, turned up field, broke a tackle, had a stiff arm, and carried two defenders to the 5-yard line. He's one of those guys that's been really special for the last 2 years. A lot of people will go back to the Baylor game to open the 2017 season. 13 catches, 192 yards, 2 touchdowns. He had a couple of one-handed grabs that game. He had a couple of spectacular touchdown receptions. One was where he got level with the defensive back, hit the accelerator, and got behind him for, you know, a really quick touchdown score. He's been someone that has also been projected as a first or second day draft pick this upcoming year with his potential, because you can't teach his size, you can't teach his speed. And a lot of scouts really love his IQ on the field, his ability to go up and catch a ball at the point of attack and really beat defenders for 50-50 balls. And that's something that he's really improved on since he arrived at Liberty. And it's something that, you know, during this final year is something that he's working to improve on even more, so that way he's better prepared for the next level.
Tell me about the defense. It gave up some nearly 200 yards rushing on the ground. It did fairly well against Syracuse quarterback, forced a few turnovers, and kept him kind of frustrated. What type of defense do the Flames run out of, and what are some of the impact players on that side of the ball, Damian?
Yeah, they run a 4-2-5, and that's Scott Simon's specialty, what he ran when he was defensive coordinator at Division II West Georgia for 4 years. Jesse Lemonnier is going to be the focal point of that defense. He's a defensive end who's kind of lined up in a hybrid position, what people have called a bandit in recent years, where kind of like a hybrid between the defensive end, outside linebacker. He went out into coverage a couple times against Syracuse, the first time he's done that in his career. But he also is really good at rushing the passer, and they'll bring him off both ends, especially on third downs when they'll move Austin Lewis from one end down into a tackle position. And then you bring in speed rushers like Elijah James and Trayvon Clark. You know, that defensive line was really good against Syracuse. And Solomon Ajayi, whose older brother Jay Ajayi is running back for the Philadelphia Eagles, he's been really stout for them, you know, last year, and then against Syracuse at Mike linebacker. He's a bit bigger body for a linebacker, but moves really well on his feet and has a really good grasp of defense. And then you look in the secondary, Elijah Benton kind of played all over the field at Rover. It's a new position that Liberty's using this year. And he's got a really good grasp of defense, and he was really able to make a lot of plays, especially in limiting what Syracuse was able to do vertically down the field. Syracuse had to resort to the screen game in order to get some positive passing yards, just because DeVito didn't have a lot of time in the pocket to get the plays downfield. So I think what Liberty was able to do in that game is going to be something totally different than what you're going to see against Louisiana, because Levi Lewis is a much more balanced quarterback than DeVito, because Lewis, a lot of times when he has his own read or plays breakdown, he can use his feet and pick up yardage in bunches. And that's something that Liberty's going to have to do differently versus Louisiana. They brought pressure against Syracuse. They might have to play a little bit more conservatively now, so that way Lewis doesn't beat them with his feet.
Damian, tell me a little bit about the status of Hugh Freeze. I know a bizarre scene of him coaching in the press box last week in a hospital bed. Explain the decision behind that, and is that what we can expect this Saturday here at Cajun Field?
Yeah, he's not sure what's going to transpire there, because I don't know if the visiting coach's booth there at Cajun Field is large enough for a hospital bed to be placed in there along with all the other coaches that need to be in the booth. So it'll be interesting. He said, you know, right now he needs to be in a position where, best case scenario, he's sitting upright and calling plays for 4+ hours. That's going to be the mindset that he's going to have going into it. The reason he was in the hospital bed in the booth was the Wednesday prior to the opener against Syracuse. He went in for an MRI, a standard checkup, and it revealed there was fluid building up in where he had the operation, so they had to drain that. And because of that, and it was a minor setback, he wasn't able to sit upright, and the doctors wanted him to stay off his feet as much as possible. So he brought in the hospital bed so that way he could be there. And it was the first time he saw the team in person since August 10th, the Saturday when they had their first scrimmage. And then the following day, he went to the hospital because of back pain. So right now he's hoping that, you know, today and then into Thursday, he's able to continue rehab, see how his back progresses, and then you know, go into the process of flying. How does he get there if, you know, he needs to lay down and not put as much pressure on his back? Do you get a private jet so that way he's not on a charter bus or a charter plane? And then transportation-wise there, how do you get him around Lafayette and then get him to the stadium, and then what accommodations do you have there? I heard Billy Napier yesterday during his press conference mentioned that they were going to try to work through some accommodations for him, and the administration there at Louisiana was taking care of that for him. So it'll be interesting to see how his back feels and then what he's able to do when he gets down to Louisiana.
We're wrapping things up here with Damian Sortolet. He covers the Liberty Flames for the News in Advance in Lynchburg, Virginia. He joins us courtesy of the ARTCO Equipment Hotline. Damian, let me go back. What's the reaction been like about the hire? Because it definitely turned heads across the country, especially in SEC country, that Liberty would take a chance on Hugh Freeze, especially concerning his baggage, not only with the fact that Ole Miss got placed on probation and stripped of scholarships under his tenure, but also the fact of his own personal controversy and scandal with the escort service in Memphis. What's the reaction been from the fan base of accepting Hugh Freeze as their head coach?
Well, it was actually rather positive in Lynchburg when the hire was made in December. And the reason for that was last January, Freeze met at Liberty, and he met with the student body at the convocation, one of the three thrice-weekly convocation meetings where the student body gathers. There's praise and worship session, then you have a guest speaker. Freeze was brought in, and it was part of the redemption tour that David Nasser, the vice president of spiritual development at Liberty, promoted. He had brought in Michael Vick, former quarterback, brought in Ray Rice, a former running back, and then he brought in Hugh Freeze. He allowed Freeze to tell his story, and Freeze got up there, told them that, you know, he had a private sin, and he admitted his private sin to his wife, Jill, to some close friends, and that, you know, he felt remorse for it. And during that time, he said this is his first opportunity in public to asked for forgiveness. And, you know, he had an opportunity to do that. You know, someone from the stands shouted, "We forgive you." You could see a burden somewhat lifted from him while watching that, because, you know, he felt acceptance there, and he felt that, you know, they weren't judging him based on an indiscretion or multiple indiscretions, however, you know, however things played out in his private life. And then through that process, Liberty was able to vet him in case they needed to hire a football coach. He was able to vet Liberty by touring the facilities, getting a chance to meet with the administration, the athletic department. And so when Turner Gill abruptly retired at the end of the season, Freeze was able to get in, was able to be contacted by Liberty. He already had a relationship there with him. And then when he was hired, people who knew about his trip to the convocation, knew about his message, they were more receptive of him because he had gotten in front of it and admitted his faults. And that's something that goes a long way in the Lynchburg community, is if you admit your faults and you're honest about it, you know, they'll forgive you and then give you a second chance. And that's something that really resonated with a lot of people in the area, because he had admitted his faults and, you know, asked for forgiveness. And that was something that, you know, nationally a lot of people didn't know that. So you had the mixed bag of reactions, but locally, you know, people were very receptive of him.
Damian, appreciate you making time out for us here, brother. Are you going to be coming down to Lafayette for the game on Saturday?
I am. I'm flying down Friday morning. Hopefully Dorian doesn't affect travel plans much, but planning on getting down there. It's my first trip to Louisiana, actually. You know, the furthest down there in the Bible Belt I've been to Mississippi, Tupelo to be specific. My mom's side of the family was born in the Florence, Muscle Shoals area of Alabama. So I've been told to get some Cajun food while I'm down there and enjoy the scenes down there in Louisiana.
Well, Damon, enjoy your trip down, man. We'll take care of you, even though you'll be covering the other team. I promise you on that, brother. So thanks for making time for us, man, and we'll talk to you soon.
I appreciate it. Thank you guys for having me on.
That's Damian Sordelet. He covers the Liberty Flames for the News in Advance in Lynchburg, Virginia. And he joined us courtesy there of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. We got to take a quick timeout. More RP3 and Company coming up after this right here on the Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. I am your host, Raymond Parts III, and this is Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Just wrapped up a terrific interview with Damon Sordelet, helping us preview Liberty Flames football. Now it's time for us to head back to high school. We've been searching around Acadiana, started off with Lafayette Parish, then ventured out to St. Martin, St. Landry. Now we're going down to the Berry, Iberia Parish today, giving you a preview right now on the Westgate Tigers. They have two of the most explosive players in all of Acadiana. Kayshawn Boutte is already an LSU commitment. They also have Son, the wide receiver. He's committed to K-State. And look, Westgate is coming off a year where they had an up-and-down season. Despite having a plethora of talent, they went 6-4 during the regular season and were eliminated early in the postseason. This is what longtime head coach Ryan Antoine, his thoughts on what the Tigers were able to do and not do last year.
We battled the injury bug real well, you know, losing our starting quarterback, losing our starting running back early on. And so just having to deal with that, and also found our identity around week 6 or 7 of what we're going to actually do and how we're going to do it. And was able to put, you know, get those pieces back. But our kids are resilient. I mean, we play with Tyrese Jackson right now, who's playing for Colorado State, who probably will start on Saturday. With only 4 games. So, I mean, so we just found a way to how to make that work. So that was kind of one of our biggest takeaways. We felt like we dropped some games in the Karen Crow game, Captain Shreve game. But the biggest disappointment, I said, was losing the Bastion, being on the 10-yard line 4 times and not coming away with any points. So, you know, that was tough for us. You know, we felt like we had them, you know, but then all in all, being able to win 7 games and have been an improvement from the year before, and, you know, hosting the first round playoff game, the first one ever at the school, was big. But now it's these guys' turn, and I, you know, want to leave it better than we found it this year.
Do better than what they have found it. Look, they have talent. the problem for Westgate has always been the depth on the O-line, on the line of scrimmage, not having those big guys that they are facing off against, the likes of, say, what Karen Crow has, who beat them last year, who's STM, who beat them last year as well. They have the skill position guys, Kayshawn Boutte and others, to be able to do that. And they did deal with an injury bug last year. Starting quarterback out, their starting running back, who's now playing at Colorado State, missed 70% of the year. So they're able to overcome inconsistencies. They were able to overcome a small line on both sides of the line of scrimmage and was able to overcome, you know, injuries to have a good season, to get to the playoffs. But they want to take that next step. Helping them do that this year are a couple of playmakers on the offensive side of the ball. That's what Coach Antoine had to say about his offense.
The biggest ones, I mean, that people don't really talk about is Joshua Castle and Tommy Nantovic. Those are our two offensive linemen who basically kind of make everything run for us up front. Two undersized guys who played on defense, and we end up moving to offense, and guys who, you know, basically just everything runs around that. They are a heartbeat of our offense, basically our team. So those are guys who kind of make everything work for us. Benny Drew is also another starter. We moved him to guard. He was our center last year. We're bringing in a new sophomore center, Ashton Francis. Bigger body, bigger kid, because we've played a lot of teams who put that big nose, you know, against Turles, SCM guys. So we feel like we need a bigger guy there for that. But, I mean, everybody knows about, you know, Kayshawn, McCoven, Jordan, Doucette. But Kavion Sofas has been playing real well for us. He could be our flex guy playing the backfield and also play some receiver. Steven Antoine is our running back, who had a real good scrimmage for us as well. So those are the guys that are going to have a two-quarterback system with Brennan Landry. He's a sophomore kid who managed the game real well, knows the offense real well. And then also Jaquelin Allen, who's kind of that jack-of-all-trades. He can move, use a lot of his legs, has a great arm as well, and just kind of just that guy who, when anything bad happens, can escape and make plays for us.
They're loaded. Westgate is loaded. Son's going to K-State. Boutte's committed to LSU. They got a lot of other guys that are going to several other different colleges. But can they get over the hump? Can they be a good team and transform into a great team this year? That's going to be the big question for the Westgate Tigers. They'll begin the season this Friday at Lafayette Christian Academy. We got to take a quick timeout when we return. Voice of the LSU Tigers, Chris Blair, joins us live right here on 103.7 The Game at Acadiana's Sports Station. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III, and we are broadcasting here on Acadiana Sports Station 103.7 The Game. We are broadcasting from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing, and we're also simulcast on Stadium Network 32.1. That's free over-the-air 24-hour sports coverage. You can also find us on LUS Fiber 133 and 1133 in high definition. We talked a little bit about what Coach Ed O had to say at his weekly presser from yesterday. We did that earlier on today's show. And to get more reaction on that press conference, as well as his thoughts on what he saw from the Tigers inside Tiger Stadium on Saturday, and to give us a preview of this Saturday's huge game against LSU versus UT, it's the one and only, the voice of the LSU Tigers, our good friend, the one and only Chris Blair. Chris, how you doing this morning, brother?
Good, man. Running hard.
I hear that, man. Let's start off with, I'll ask you this question first. Was Saturday's game the most complete performance, offense, defense, and special teams that you've seen from LSU since you've been the voice of the Tigers?
100%. As fluid run and as well-designed and executed as I've ever seen.
So, how impressive. Now, look, you've been around the program. You've been watching them. Probably have more access than most of us do, Chris. Were you surprised on just how efficient and dominant they were in the season opener on Saturday?
Not really dominant. It didn't surprise me, but I was super surprised by how well they executed an offense that, you know, everybody talked about being the first year and a new offense. I mean, it looked like the guys had been running that offense 5 or 6 seasons. I mean, they ran tempo at some points in the game faster than any team I've ever seen, and do it pretty flawlessly, you know, play after play after play. And to me, that's what stood out.
We're talking with Chris Blair, the voice of the LSU Tigers. He joins us courtesy of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. Chris,
Tell me what you thought of Joe Burrow. Man, he really does look like he is going to thrive and love playing in this Joe Brady slash Steve Ensminger offense.
Well, you know, they told us going into the season that, you know, this is what made him a star in Athens, Ohio, put him on the map of, you know, the top schools across the country, including Ohio State. LSU was lucky enough to get his services down here in the Bayou after finishing up his degree and being able to play right away. And he may look like a fish to water. I mean, it looked like what he's most comfortable doing, and he executed at a very high level. You know, 86% pass completions. Again, most of his time out there, they were running tempo, running at a high speed. I thought he orchestrated the offense well, had a command of where guys needed to be, set them up in the right position, and then executed the plays. And looked like he had taken those steps you expect in a transfer quarterback who had a really good 2018. What are the natural steps and progression going into the second season? You know, a lot of football left to be played, but after week one, I think he's made those steps.
We're talking with Chris Blair, the voice of the LSU Tigers. He joins us courtesy of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. Chris, I want to talk about Terrence Marshall because, you know, we all know what his potential was. We saw flashes of it last year, but he just couldn't get into the end zone. Well, he took care of that on Saturday as he got into the end zone three times. Your thoughts on what you saw from Terrence Marshall and him being able to step up in a huge way on Saturday?
Yeah, I think Marshall, you know, is super pleased for Terrence because, you know, he came into to school, you know, coming off an injury. And, you know, I'm not sure he ever felt like, because he was trying to get back to 100% physically, that he was truly there. And as you said, we saw some flashes of him last year and why, you know, he was highly sought out. This year, having, you know, having those physical issues behind him and locked into this offense, just great to see him because it boosts his confidence and tells him, yes, I belong, and this is what I was supposed to be doing, and this is why I'm an LSU Tiger and why Coach O and Steve Ensminger wanted me on this team. That being said, what I'm most excited about is that Marshall had the night last week, and I think it's just going to be one of those deals this season, if everything continues in the right way, that you're going to have Marshall with a night. Jefferson, who's led, by the way, with the most receptions, he's going to have a night scoring points. Jamar Chase is going to have a night. There's a chance of freshman Trey Palmer could have. I mean, the list goes on and on. So I think we're going to have to get accustomed to, based on this offense and based on what they want to do, that on a given night, one of these receivers is going to have one of those record-setting days.
We're talking with Chris Blair, the voice of the LSU Tigers. He joins us courtesy of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. Chris, I want to talk about the other side of the ball. Look, Georgia Southern's triple option attack, more of a pistol triple option attack, but still it's highly effective, and they run it to a T. This is a team that won 10 games a year ago and won their bowl game. So this is not a chump by any stretch of the imagination. Yet Dave Aranda went out there and made them look silly, Chris. Held them to less than 100 yards total offense. He had all summer to game plan for it, and it showed.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about Georgia Southern, and I know this very well, is that they play in these games quite a bit. And while they haven't won many of them, they've always been able to find the end zone, whether it's early in a game by surprising the team or either late in the game. They're also able to rack up, you know, some decent yardage. And for them to come away without a touchdown and held to just 98 yards of total offense just speaks to the domination of LSU's defense. Now, I've got a lot of friends who were in town Saturday for the ball game from Statesboro in the Savannah, Atlanta, and Macon area. And they were all, you know, dejected, to say the very least, after
right.
The performance. But I told them, I said, I'm not so sure, guys, that this is an indication on Georgia Southern or how bad they're going to be or how lacking they have in both offense and defense, as much as it speaks to the strength of LSU. You know, I think Dave Aranda dialed up a great game plan. He's got a defense that, you know, first of all, is anchored by Tyler Shelvin, who, you know, anywhere between 350 and 360 pounds, and actually moves pretty good for a guy that size. That's number one. I mean, that's going to help you defend the dive just simply because he's taking up space. Now you compact the fact that he's athletic. You know, I think he hurt them quite a bit. May have, without question, played his best game in his career at LSU. Then you've got a guy like Kalon Chaisson, who's, you know, he's just coming. He's going to be in the backfield against a lot of offensive lines this season. He was disrupting things. Jacoby Stevens, I thought, along with Grant Delpit, did a great job of making Georgia Southern run that offense in a phone booth. But they didn't give them good angles. They didn't give them good lanes. And they just they pretty much textbook how you stop a triple option team, especially out of the shotgun. Now, you know, under center and the flex bones a little bit differently. Because to be honest with you, what Georgia Southern runs now is, although a lot of triple option philosophy, it's not a lot different than what you see just about every other team run with the zone read. So I thought LSU defended it about as good as possible. And if there's teams out there trying to defend Georgia Southern's offense, they will definitely want to get their hands on this film.
We're talking with Chris Blair. He is the voice of the LSU Tigers. He joins us courtesy of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. One final question about this past weekend, Chris, before we move forward to the game ahead. Damone Clark, you know, Coach O had told us about this guy from spring and throughout the summer. He kept bringing him up about just how good of a football player he was, and he had a hell of a game on Saturday. I know Michael Divinity is going to be back into the lineup for Texas, but you're going to have to continue having Damone Clark out there in some sort of capacity, right? He's still going to get game reps.
Yeah, career high 9 tackles. And, you know, not only were he making 9 tackles, I mean, some of the plays that he made are just things you look at on film and go, wow, that's a serious linebacker. And, you know, there's a ton of teams across the country who would love to have Damone Clark, and he'd be starting. Just so happens he's in a very talent-rich linebacking core at LSU. Having said all that, Coach O yesterday in his weekly press conference was asked about it and basically said as much. We've got to find time to put him on the field. Well, that's a good problem to have.
Yeah.
If you got Michael Divinity, Patrick Queen, Jacob Phillips, those guys, you know, yeah, they're built to play an entire game, but the ability to say, hey, we're going to replace one of you or make, you know, obviously Michael Divinity at the inside spot to give him, you know, a little time to rest. I mean, you really don't have much of a drop-off. So it's going to be interesting to see how those linebackers are utilized this weekend in a hot environment. They kick off around 6:45, actually. They say 6:30, but it's college game day, and TV's got to do what they got to do.
Oh,
so
yeah.
They're looking at about 6:44 before they kick it off. But it's expected to be about 98 degrees. Now, the humidity will be a little relative, which will be nice. But in that environment, on that stage, with that type of matchup, I really look forward to Damone Clark to see his opportunities in that linebacking core on the field on that kind of stage. And, you know, as I said, Coach Jeff kind of touched on that yesterday. It's nice to have an abundance of riches like LSU has currently, knock on wood, in that linebacker spot.
We're talking with Chris Blair, the voice of the LSU Tigers. He joins us courtesy of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. Chris, I want to talk about this Saturday's game. Let's go on the offensive side of the ball. Texas players have already been coming out and saying they're not even watching any film from last year. The only film that they've been watching is what occurred in the opener because of the new-look offense of LSU. What's going to be key for LSU going into Austin against that Texas defense? What's some of those key matchups for you?
Well, I think it's going to be their defensive backs against this LSU receiving core. When you look at Todd Orlando, the defensive coordinator for Texas, I mean, typically he's a guy that likes to bring pressure and likes to bring it a lot. It's going to be interesting should they watch that film from last week, and that's all the film that they watch. Are you really going to send the house against Joe Burrow, who was, you know, releasing the football in 2.5 seconds, and, oh, by the way, has multiple targets, 5 receivers, including the tight end, make that 6 targets with your running back sneaking out. And LSU showed the propensity to use receivers, tight ends, and running backs. And they threw to 14 different receivers, 5 running backs caught the ball on Saturday. So to me, if that's the film they're going by and that's the game plan being built, I'll be interested to see if Texas is that aggressive or if they show a lot of blitz and then back up and try to fill those passing lanes, because you saw the middle of the field wide open all night long last week. And that's because you just have more numbers out there ready to catch the football. So, you know, it'll be – we'll see how that goes. Obviously Texas has done a lot of jawing here over the last little bit, in fact, going back to the offseason. All that's over with now. Time for talk is over. They wore their DBU T-shirts, which I don't know, felt like to me it was just honoring LSU, but I guess that's what they think they are. They certainly didn't put up DBU numbers last week against Louisiana Tech. They only gave up 14 points, but they let them throw for like 360-plus yards. So they let Joe Burrow throw for 360-plus yards. There'll be more than 14 points up on the board. So, again, I think the matchup is going to be the receivers and the defensive backs, and whether or not Texas and the Longhorn defense continues to just bring pressure with reckless abandon.
Wrapping things up here with Chris Blair, voice of the LSU Tigers. He joins us courtesy of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. Chris, let's go on the other side of the ball. We've heard a lot, and there's been a lot of pub about the Texas quarterback. He's rewriting the record books. He's putting his name beside the likes of Vince Young and others. What kind of challenges does he present LSU's defense?
Ellinger's is a solid quarterback, one of the tops in the country, and the value he brings to his team is probably as high as anybody else in the country. Just because of all the things he does. He's a solid, strong runner that they design the run occasionally, but even when plays break down, he's able to, make those fantastic plays that you if you're a defensive coordinator, you just want to, scratch your eyes out. And then he's a really good passer. And, they've got some really good receivers. I mean, some sizable receivers that will present quite a bit of challenge to DBU, the real DBU. Are they going to decide to pick on Fulton? Are they going to stay away from him? Are they going to try to go against Stingley, the true freshman? Are they going to try to stay away from him? And how does Grant Delpit match in all that? And I think Grant Delpit's kind of the X factor, and I think he will be in most games this season. Had a quiet game overall against Georgia Southern, but he had his teammates pretty much taking care of business everywhere else. But he's going to be, interesting in this matchup because of Ellinger's ability to run, sometimes by design, sometimes by necessity, as well as be able to help in that passing game to get some, some double-team matchups out there in the flat or in the corners. So that to me is how you're going to defend. I think their running game, they've got a decent young runner, but they've been kind of hit pretty rough with the injury bug here of late, especially at running back. I don't know that they have that solid running game just yet in week number two. So I got to believe Dave Aranda's first option is let's stop the run and force Ellinger to beat us by himself throwing and running the football. And then that's when it's going to take over with the linebackers and the defensive secondary. And I think they're going to bring pressure. I think they're going to want to front a flush Ellinger out, get him outside the pocket, and then have somebody else, whether it's Calavon Chasson that's moving the pocket and flushing him out, somebody else to come in and clean up like a Jacoby Stevens or a Grant Delpit. So I don't see LSU doing anything but staying aggressive in this game on Saturday.
Chris, appreciate your time as always. Enjoy Austin. And do a tremendous job on the call, as always, my friend. Appreciate you making the time for us.
No problem. You guys have a great rest of the week. Go Tigers.
That's Chris Blair, voice of the LSU Tigers, joining us courtesy of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. We got to take a time out here, but we'll be back with more RP3 and Company right after this on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. We just wrapped up a terrific conversation with Chris Blair, the voice of the LSU Tigers. That has prompted us to create a new poll question, which we're posting as we speak. That'll be available at 103.7thegame.com. Quick update on our poll question from yesterday. We asked you, what did Saturday's game between the UL Raging Cajuns and Mississippi State Bulldogs, what did that say more about? Who did that say more about? Was it UL or was it Mississippi State? 75% of you said it told you more about the Raging Cajuns. Optimism abounds for Billy Napier's squad. Our latest poll question, which we will also be tweeting out a link to, this is based on our conversation with Chris Blair, is
What is the biggest matchup in Saturday's LSU-Texas game? The key to the game, if you will. Is it going to be the LSU wide receivers against the Texas defensive backs? Or will it be Texas's quarterback versus LSU's defense? What is going to be the biggest matchup, the biggest key in Saturday's game, LSU at UT? You can go vote on that right now at 1037thegame.com. You can also call us if you'd like and give us your thoughts on the ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. Right now, though, we got to hit a quick time out. When we return here on RP3 and Company, college football talk. We'll continue it more of an SEC and national feel from one of the best in the business, senior columnist from Saturday Down South, Connor O'Gara, joins us live right here on 103.7 The Game, Acadiana Sports Station.
It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parch III talks sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. Legendary Southern University baseball coach Roger Cador.
That 1985 class that I recruited, I told those young men that they were going to be a part of history. What kind of history, I didn't know, but I told them they would be a part of history. And in 1987, they go out and beat Cal State Fullerton, yeah, which was the history I was talking about.
LSU national champion and Super Bowl champion Marlon Favorite.
It made me feel comfortable to go to work every day at LSU, knowing that he embraced my passion and my love for music as well. We had fun. We were freestyling locker room. Coach Miles would come and dance.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Good morning. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. I am your host, Raymond Parch III. We're broadcasting right here from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing, and you are listening to Acadiana Sports Station 103.7 The Game. I want to thank you for making us part of your morning. Hope you got to work okay, or if you're still traveling to work, be safe out there. College football season has begun. It's officially in. We got 1 week in. Week two is coming up. It feels great. A lot of things are in midseason form. Trolling is in midseason form, especially from our fans there at Georgia State, among others. And look, they have every right to troll Tennessee because, well, you go into Knoxville and you beat an SEC team that paid you $950,000. You can troll them all day long. We'll talk about that particular troll job, as well as highlights from week one and the marquee games of week two, as we welcome on our next guest. He is the senior columnist for Saturday Down South and SaturdayTradition.com. He's one of the best in the business, friend of the show. It's the one and only Connor O'Gara. Connor, good morning to you. How you doing, brother?
Doing well, man. I feel like I'm in midseason form. I'm amazed already that, like, technically for me, it's entering my third weekend of college football. So I guess I don't really have any excuses anymore to be, like, slow or rusty with my thoughts.
Let's talk about week one. Yeah, that's right. You are considering. You did technically have to work for that abomination that was the Florida-Miami game. So I understand, and God bless you for working through that, my friend. I know that had to be difficult. Let's start off with Tennessee. I have to start there. We keep waiting for them to come back. We keep waiting for Tennessee to return to being a national program. They were never the best program in the country, but at least they were relevant, and they were a top 25 team year in and year out, a bowl team year in and year out. And ever since they fired Philip Fulmer, it has been an absolute dumpster fire, bad coaching hire after bad coaching hire after bad coaching hire. They thought they had it fixed with this latest coaching hire, and then on Saturday, there, amongst the checkerboard pattern of the end zone, they lose to a 2-win team from the Sun Belt Conference. Your thoughts on what the hell happened to Tennessee, Connor?
Can you imagine if Butch Jones had lost this game? Oh. I thought about that a little bit. I mean, just Butch Jones or Derek Dooley, either one of them. If they had lost that game, I don't know if they get home to their respective families. Like I don't know how that works and how they're able to show up to work on Monday. The good news for Jeremy Pruitt is that he has built up, obviously, a great rapport. And I think if you would have asked a Tennessee fan at this time a week ago, they would have said, yeah, Pruitt's going to be the guy to rebuild us. And so, yes, this is a one-off, and it doesn't necessarily feed into the week two, or the year two narrative that Jeremy Pruitt is on the rise. But, you know, at the same time, like, I think all of a sudden fans are really questioning what they've thought this entire offseason. College football is so unique in that you have 8 months to really sit there and think about what the season is supposed to look like. And for Tennessee fans, I've been saying this all offseason, if there was a team in the country that I was going to bet on improving its win total from last year, it was Tennessee. And I think that Vols fans are going into that week one game feeling like, all right, we got our new high-priced offensive coordinator in Jim Chaney. We've got our defensive-minded coach in Jeremy Pruitt. We've got a team that returns more of its production than any of the Power 5 teams in the country last year. We feel like we should be in good shape in year two, maybe win 7-8 games, go to a bowl game, yada, yada, yada. To have a game like that, it just takes the wind out of your sail immediately, because it's not the Tennessee fans thought they're going to compete with Georgia this year necessarily and that they were going to push for a division title. But to have that reality check in week one, probably the easiest game on your schedule, a game that you were going to look at and say, yeah, we're finally going to have a feel-good game. Let's not forget that Tennessee is unique in that it hasn't had a win against an FBS program by at least 28 points since the 2015 Outback Bowl. This was that chance, and they absolutely blew it. And it was coaching, it was execution, it was everything that you hoped was in the past. And for Tennessee fans, yeah, it is a troubling thought to think that that is the way that this team showed up out of the gates in week one. It's different if it's like week three, you've already had a couple of wins, and it's just a dud. You have a chance to move past it. But that was a deflating game for a Tennessee fan base that was ready to feel all sorts of good heading into year two.
We're talking with Connor O'Gara of Saturday Down South. He joins us courtesy of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. Speaking of deflating, a lot of preseason hype about Mizzou. And they go out and looked absolutely dreadful. What happened to the Tigers of Missouri, Connor?
Well, if you can't stop the run, it's hard to win a football game. And if you can't stop a 6-win Mountain West team from running the ball right down your throat, how are you supposed to win? You know, like the fact that they allowed nearly 300 rushing yards to a Mountain West team is just it's inexcusable. I mean, you cannot have that. If you're Barry Odom, a defensive-minded coach, you cannot allow a 35-minute stretch in that game in which you get outscored 34-3. That's an awful look. That says to me, you don't know how to make adjustments in-game. You're getting out-coached. Your players aren't able to stop the bleeding. You don't have an alpha on that defense that can step up and say, hey, look, let's put this thing to bed. And I know they had offensive miscues and turnovers in that game, but still, that is just an awful, awful look for Barry Odom. And, you know, I didn't really buy as much of the Mizzou hype that other people were. Are saying that they're going to go into that Georgia game undefeated, and I'm like, no, this is not going to happen. Barry Odom's teams never start off well. For whatever reason, his teams just don't come out of the gate good. They don't. They finish much better than they start, and we end up moving him off the hot seat pretty much, you know, every November after his team rattles off a few wins in a row. But to get off to a start like this where you're a 3-score favorite, you're excited about your quarterback, you've had this offseason of kind of us versus the world with the bowl ban and all the injustices that have gone on with that, and then to lay an egg like that in week one, yeah, if you're a Mizzou fan, you're wondering how in the world is this team going to stop the run in the SEC? If you allow 300 rushing yards to that team, I don't know what they're going to do against Florida. I don't know what they're going to do against Kentucky. I definitely don't think they're going to be able to stop the run against Georgia in that offensive line. But Mizzou had an absolute just meltdown up in a weird, you know, weird way to open the season in Laramie. But yeah, I mean, there is still some saving grace in the fact that Barry Odom has been able to turn these bad starts around in the past. Kelly Bryant was able to throw the ball well. But, man, improvement needs to come, and it needs to come in a hurry.
Jalen Hurts will win the Heisman. Your thoughts on that statement?
I mean, I'm not gonna dismiss it. At the same time, I mean, he probably wouldn't be my first bet as of right now. I mean, that's a Houston defense with a new coaching staff that, you know, let's call it what it is. It's not going to be the best defense that Jalen Hurts faced. Having said that, he looked brilliant. And you know, he really fired on all cylinders in every facet of the game. Every Oklahoma fan that was hoping, all right, you know, maybe this could be third year in a row where our quarterback really takes that next step and really, you know, just has the best year of their career by far and looks like the best quarterback in the country. That was the game they wanted to see out of Jalen Hurts, and it just kind of speaks to his maturation and how seriously he took the criticism that he faced going into last offseason, where everybody's saying, you know, he can't throw, he's not a thrower, he's one read, and then he runs the ball, and that's what he was in Brian Daboll's offense in 2017. That's ultimately why he got benched for Tua Tagovailoa in the national championship. But credit the work that he's been able to put in with working with a guy like Dan Enos, who really helped develop him as a passer, and it's mental, it's physical with him. But the tools are there, and I think the people that have looked at Jalen Hurts in the past and said there's no way he's ever going to be an NFL quarterback, not here, not now, whatever, he's just an average quarterback. I think they saw that game in week one, and they're like, all right, you know what? I guess with Lincoln Riley, you know, there are some things that are that you know, he can take quarterbacks to the next level, and he can really make them shine and look like they're absolute best. And credit Jalen Hurts because he came out ready to go. He looks like a man on a mission, and for the rest of the country, especially the Big 12, that's a very scary thought.
Talking with Connor O'Gara of Saturday Down South as well as SaturdayTradition.com. He joins us courtesy of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. Connor, I'll ask you, Willie Taggart, does he survive this season?
You know, if I'm betting money on it, I'm going to say yes. But his seat is hotter than maybe anybody's in the country, maybe with the exception of Will Muschamp, heading into 2020. And, you know, I have not been high on anything that he's done. If we're being 100% honest, I really have not liked the entire approach that he's taken with his team. I have not liked how a lot of people have come out and defended him and said it's all Jimbo Fisher's fault and he left the program in shambles. Yeah, there's some truth in that. There's some truth in the way that Jimbo left Florida State, but his team is completely undisciplined, still, and that's a sign of coaching. That's not just Jimbo Fisher having a lasting impact on this team. Florida State is a disaster, and I even turned to my SDS podcast co-host Chris Marler when Florida State went up 31-13. I said, you know, it's going to be a real shame when Florida State blows this lead and loses this game. And then sure enough, what do they do against a group of five team at home? They blow an 18-point lead, and they lose that game. It's just become so predictable at this point with Willie Taggart. And, you know, you could question a lot of the social media stuff that they've had. And, you know, obviously that doesn't necessarily fall under Taggart's umbrella, but his program is just not looking like the Florida State that we've grown accustomed to seeing for the last 30 years. And, you know, to think that it's going to turn into Bobby Bowden's program overnight is unrealistic, obviously. But, man, you needed to come out of the gates and pick up a win in week one against a Boise State team that, you know, traveled all the way across the country to come play in your home stadium. So, yeah, I wouldn't be feeling good about Willie Taggart's chances beyond, let's say, 2020. But, yeah, I don't necessarily think that they're going to make that decision that quickly when they obviously, you know, kind of, you know, put their neck out to be able to hire somebody like him.
Connor, you wrote an article and you posted it yesterday, a very good article about how huge of a weekend this is for the SEC because of the two marquee matchups, LSU-Texas, Texas A&M, Clemson. How big are those games, not only for the SEC, but for the national championship picture? It's weird to say that because it's week two, but yet these two games have huge implications down the road.
No, these games are absolutely huge. And I go back to that 2017 game against with Georgia and Notre Dame and how the selection committee talked about that game throughout the season and how that was such a big sticking point. And really, I think that these home-and-homes are just so huge, and that's not to slight all neutral site games, but I think these games matter more. I think they give the selection committee a better idea of, all right, if the fourth or fifth or sixth best team, whatever you think Texas A&M is, if they go into Clemson and if they pull off an upset, ACC's in rough shape this year, absolutely rough shape. Now, I don't think that that's going to happen, but at the same time, A&M has a huge opportunity to make a loud statement for the SEC, much like they did last year. I'd argue it's even different this year now with the fact that they've been just so dominant and blowing everybody out basically since that game. Well, since the Syracuse game last year where Trevor Lawrence was injured, they've dominated everyone. And if A&M goes into Death Valley and hangs tight for four quarters like they did last year, that bodes extremely well for the SEC. And, you know, on the other side, you know, with the LSU and Texas game, if LSU does go into Austin and does pull off that upset, well, it's not an upset. That game is essentially a coin flip. I misphrased. I didn't phrase that correctly. But if they go into to Austin and pull out and get a win there, then that says just everything that you need to know about SEC contenders. That you know, put the likes of Georgia and Alabama, and if you want to include Auburn and Florida in that conversation as well, they're legit. And people won't be able to necessarily say that the SEC is overrated at the top and that LSU is getting too much love. Remember last year when everybody's saying that LSU is getting too much love for a one or a two loss team, even though they had those wins against top 10 opponents to start the year. That's not going to happen this year if LSU goes into Texas and gets a victory. And I think it's just a huge opportunity for the conference itself when the non-conference slate this year is just not that good outside of what the SEC has going. The SEC has the biggest opportunities to make those non-conference statements, and that's really what's going to dictate how we're going to view the conference going into this season. It's not necessarily going to be, oh, an SEC team lost to a group of five team in week one. That's not what the playoff selection committee is going to really come back to. It's these big non-conference headliners. And the SEC, that the top six teams got off to a really nice start, and they have a chance to really build on it in week two. But, yeah, there is definitely a lot up for grabs here. And talk about a must-win game for the ACC in terms of their playoff chances. Absolutely need to get that one if you're Clemson, of course. But, you know, this is just a huge weekend overall, and we'll be talking about it for the next few months.
Connor, appreciate your time as always. Keep up the great work and enjoy this weekend slate of games, my friend. We'll be in touch.
Yep, sounds good. Appreciate it.
That's Connor O'Gara, Saturday Down South and SaturdayTradition.com. He posted a story earlier on today that you need to go check out at SaturdayDownSouth.com. Nearly 3 years later, LSU is better off with Ed Orgeron than Tom Herman. I recommend you go check that out from our friend Connor O'Gara. We got to take a quick timeout. When we come back, more high school season previews. Ooh, New Iberia Senior High is next, right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. I'm your host, Raymond Parks III, and we are broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. And this is Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Nish, New Iberia Senior High. The Yellow Jackets have a new man in charge. It's Kurt Ware. After a very successful run as the head coach at Rain High School, he's making the jump up to Class 5A now, taking over the Yellow Jackets. Nish is coming off a season, though, where they were 2-8. The lone kind of highlight of the year was a surprising 8-7 win over Como, who was a playoff team. But Nish has been down for more than a few years. They haven't made the playoffs since 2013, when they went 8-2 in the regular season and advanced to the second round of the Class 5A playoffs. In fact, the last 5 years, the team has only been averaging 3 wins per season. But Kurt Ware is up to the challenge of not only turning around the Yellow Jackets, but stepping up and playing in 3-5A, one of the toughest districts in the state of Louisiana.
I just welcome the challenge of coaching at the 5A level. And obviously, if not the best district in the state, definitely one of the best districts in the state. I think it's a challenge, and I look forward to doing it.
He's up for it. He's amped up. He's ready to go. What can you see that's going to be different from what Coach Rick Hudson did at Nish compared to what Coach Kurt Ware has done in his career, especially on the offensive side of the ball? Well, this is what he's going to be. It's going to be a different mindset when the Yellow Jackets have the ball.
Well, it's just a totally different mindset as far as offensive football. I mean, Coach Hudson's spread offense is more finesse and get the ball out of your hands and screens and all that. And there's a lot of ways to skin a cat, as they say. And we're more of a, you know, kind of success with running the football, controlling the clock. And I think it's become even a better offense today than it was 20 years ago because teams don't see it. So right. It's a little bit more difficult to prepare for.
A little bit more difficult to prepare for, helping change that new run, that new offense there at Nish. He has a few impact players that he's already high on through fall camp entering the season. This is what Coach Ware had to say about that side of the ball. Who's going to be leading the Yellow Jackets on offense?
Tyce Fusilier, who's going to be a junior. He's a good running back. He played a little running back last year and some corner. I think big things from him. And, of course, Tegan Bork, who started last year at quarterback. Again, different scheme, and so he's got a little learning curve, but he's gotten better and better and better. So expect big things from both those guys.
What is Nish going to look like defensively? They lost one of their best players, linebackers, now at UL. So what are they going to be doing on that side of the ball? Coach Ware is excited about his defense.
We're a 4-2-5.
4-2-5.
Yeah, they were. I think they were more 3-4 last year. So there's been a little learning curve right there on both sides of the ball. But defensively, they weren't bad on defense last year. We got some experience back, so I think we should be all right.
I asked Coach Ware what his mantra was going to be for this program. Look, he's taking over a program, once again, hasn't made the postseason since 2013 and has been averaging 3 wins a year for the last 5 years. Expectations have to be pretty low, but I asked him, what is he instilling? How is he trying to build up the Yellow Jackets into what he wants this program to be? This is what he said his mantra is going to be for this program.
Well, I tell them every day, so I preach to you every day, is toughness. Yeah, the game of football is for tough people. Tough people usually succeed in football. A lot of people play football, and it doesn't mean you're tough just because you play the game.
Right.
So mental toughness, playing hard for 4 quarters, 9 times out of 10 in high school football, the team that plays the hardest, you got a good chance to win.
The team that plays the toughest, plays the hardest, has a good chance to win. Old school coaching philosophy there from Coach Kurt Ware. Old school type of offense. He wants his team to be tough. It may take a little while, but you could see Nish start to have a turnaround, though, sooner than later. Look, Coach said, he also says his team has to keep an even keel no matter what happens, wins or losses this season.
Well, the good thing about it is it's not a new district to them. They've been playing in it. So that's a big advantage. The thing about it is we can't get too high or too low. You know, week in, week out, it's going to be a big challenge. So if you win a big game, you can't celebrate. If you lose a close game, you can't be too down. So you just got to kind of even keel, not too high, not too low.
Not too high, not too low. Coach Kurt Ware, new head coach with the Nish Yellow Jackets. Look, he's going to try to bring some toughness there. He's going to try to turn things around for one of the better programs, used to be one of the best programs in all of Acadiana. Kurt Ware is trying to make that happen there at Nish. Guys, in Louisiana, there are thousands of miles of utility lines and gas pipelines buried just beneath the surface. Sometimes multiple lines are in one area. So if you or a contractor you've hired is digging a hole to put in a new fence, a pool, or for whatever reason, you run the risk of hitting an underground line even by digging only a few inches. What happens then? Maybe you only knock the power out for your entire neighborhood. But sometimes there's an explosion with injuries and even death. It happens every single year, and there's a very simple way to avoid it. Before you dig, call 811. Call 811 2 days before you dig, tell the operator your address, and someone will come out and mark the location of those buried lines so you and your contractor can avoid them. Simple, right? It's free of charge, and it's the law. Louisiana One Call operates 811 as a public service and to promote public safety. Louisiana One Call and 103.7 The Game remind you, call 811 and know what's below before you dig. Coming up, our conversation with Lars Anderson, New York Times best-selling author, will join us right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Good morning. Welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III, and you are listening to Acadiana Sports Station 103.7 The Game. We are broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. We're also simulcast on Stadium Network 32.1. That's free over the air, 24-hour sports coverage. You can also find us on LUS Fiber 133 and 1133 in high definition. It's time now for us to head back out to the ARTCO Equipment Hotline and welcome on our fourth and final guest of the day. And I'm going to tell you, he's about to class up the place. He is a New York Times best-selling author of 6 books, including The Storm and The All-Americans, and one of my personal favorites, The Mannings, The Fall and Rise of a Football Family. He's a 20-year veteran of Sports Illustrated. He's also been a senior writer at Bleacher Report and is currently an instructor of journalism at the University of Alabama. His latest book is Chasing the Bear, How Bear Bryant and Nick Saban Made Alabama the Greatest College Football Program of All Time. His name is Lars Anderson, and he now joins us courtesy of the ARTCO Equipment Hotline. Lars, good morning to you. Appreciate your time, my man.
Hey, good morning to you, and thank you so much for having me on. Definitely appreciate it.
Let's get right to it. Obviously, you are serving as a professor there at the University of Alabama, but you've also been a longstanding sports writer for Sports Illustrated. So you know college football better than most. Where did the idea, the genesis of this book, this dual biography of Bear Bryant and Nick Saban, where did that start? Where did that stem from?
It's been percolating for a long time. I lived in New York City when I worked at SI for 15 years. moved down, like a lot of people who moved south from New York City, followed a girl down to Birmingham, Alabama. And I arrived in Alabama just about the same time that Nick Saban did, and did several stories on Nick for SI. Wrote a book, as you referenced, The Storm and the Tide, about the tornado that went through Tuscaloosa back in 2011. Spent a lot more time with Coach Saban. And I feel like I have a really good grasp of who he is and what makes him tick, what motivates him. And, you know, I just heard story after story of Bear Bryant, and I never met Bear Bryant. For this project, he really talked to me through the book that he wrote, also through I've interviewed, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of former players, of confidants of his. And so what I wanted to do was kind of stack them up side by side, write this dual biography, and not just do a dry year-by-year look at each coach, but look at larger themes. And is there anything to be learned when you examine them sort of side-by-side in real time? You know, looking at Bear Bryant, his arrival at Alabama, comparing that to Nick Saban. You know, Bear Bryant came in a Cadillac and with his wife at his side, the dog in the back seat. You know, Saban flies in on a jet to a lot of fanfare. And what caused Bryant to come to Alabama where he played, and what were the secrets to the coaching search for Mal Moore, the AD at the time, in getting Saban to leave Miami and come to Alabama, and then the challenges that each one faced, and what were the sort of distinguishing factors of each coach? Why was each coach able to be successful? You know, I looked at both of them, their willingness to embrace change and try to stay ahead of what other coaches are doing. And then with Bryant, it was adopting the wishbone, and that really triggered a career renaissance for him in the second half of his career and led to more national championships. And for Saban, it was his willingness to bring in Lane Kiffin and go to the wide open spread attack that he had fought so hard against, and said that this type of offense leads to injuries because there's more plays being run and players are tired and we can't substitute and all this stuff. Like, if you remember, Saban went on a rant for several months about this style of play, and now he's sort of at the forefront of it with Tua. But the larger point is that each coach is willing to embrace change. And Saban especially, you know, when he made the decision to go to this style of offense, it really goes back to the kick six game, that famous game against Auburn in the Iron Bowl in 2013. Everybody remembers the return for the touchdown on the missed field goal attempt. But the key play of that game, sort of in the history of Nick Saban, occurred before the kick six. And that was when the Auburn quarterback, Nick Marshall, ran an RPO to his left, and he tucked the ball in, looked like he was going to run, and at the last second flicked the ball about 40 yards downfield to a wide-open Sammy Coates. Well, when he did that, Auburn had four or five offensive linemen who were beyond that imaginary three-yard mark. It should have been, and as Saban said, you know, it should have been a legal lineman downfield, but referees just simply weren't calling that on RPOs. And after the game, Saban said, if this is how the game is moving and this is how referees are calling the game, I've got to change. And at the time, nobody really knew exactly what he was talking about, but he was certainly referencing that particular play. And so then what does Saban do? That as Alabama is preparing to play in the Sugar Bowl, he invites Lane Kiffin, who had just been disgraced and fired at USC, and he invites him in to observe practice. And every day after practice, Lane would come to Nick's house, and they'd have dinner, and they would exchange ideas. And that led to Nick hiring Lane and changing the offense all around. And you know, Nick also invited Tom Herman, the offensive coordinator, at Ohio State at the time, after Ohio State eviscerated Alabama's defense in the Sugar Bowl several years ago, and when Herman just had become the head coach at Houston. And Herman was amazed by what happened in that meeting, is that Saban called him in, and Saban drilled him on questions for 30, 45 minutes. And Herman really never had a chance to ask Saban anything, because Saban is just, he wanted to acquire information. How did you beat me? How do you practice? How does your offense work? And ultimately it led to Saban making that radical change. And I think even today Saban is uncomfortable with this offense. He would much rather have a power pro style running attack with a game manager at quarterback, but he knew that he couldn't win national championships with another A.J. McCarron type of player back there. And so he went out and got a guy like Tua. And so it really, again, the both coaches showed this willingness and malleability, whereas a lot of coaches don't. They want to stick with their system, and that, you know, no matter what, even if their players don't necessarily fit that system, they're going to run their system. But both Brian and Saban didn't do that.
We're talking with Lars Anderson. He's the New York Times bestselling author. His latest is Chasing the Bear. It's on bookshelves now. Lars, they both have similar backgrounds as well. Bear, of course, famously grew up very blue-collar, rural area, small town, grew up on a farm, learned hard work from his father because his father couldn't really work all that much, had his ailments, as you allude to in the book. Saban grew up working in his father's filling station there in West Virginia. Both come from blue-collar backgrounds, both learned hard work from their fathers, and both started their careers as coaches somewhat like nomads, right? They traveled around, both actually coached SEC schools previously as head men before even arriving at Alabama. Of course, Bear at Kentucky, Saban here at LSU. What were some of the other comparisons that you found from that background, their childhood, that they both carried over into their coaching careers?
Yeah, I mean, they both, like you said, it was really, you know, the secret sauce to both of them is not complicated. It can be distilled into two words, and it's hard work. And there's nothing. I mean, it all boils down to that. And I know people want to know what the magic blueprint is, but there simply isn't one. It's just they're going to outwork you. And that was something they learned from their fathers. Both of their dads also died at age 46, and they were both young men when their fathers passed away. And that, I think, infused them with a sense of urgency. You know, don't sort of waste the early part of your life you know, traveling Europe or whatever you want to do. Like, they both wanted to get into coaching right away. And they both found something at Alabama which they hadn't found anywhere else. And that was, one, you know, if you ask for something, the administration's going to get it for you. And, you know, when Saban arrived, most people thought that he would be at Alabama for 5-6 years tops, and then he would move on, because he was known, as you alluded to, as a guy who took over a program that needed to be fixed. He would fix it, get it to an elite level, and then move on to the next challenge. And I think what changed with Saban was the 2011 tornado that I talked about earlier. I did a whole book on it and the impact on Saban and Alabama football. But really, in the hours after that tornado, which was one of the worst in the history of the South, and 6 students lost their lives, I think over 70 people in Tuscaloosa alone lost their lives, you know, Saban went into the hardest hit neighborhoods, and over the course of 48 hours, he literally physically hugged more people than he ever had in the entirety of his life. And just listen to people tell their stories, listen to people who literally lost everything, including sons and daughters. And that did something profound to him and to Miss Terry, his wife, as she's known in Alabama. And it made Saban not just a coach, it made him a community leader. It made him someone that even non-football fans in Tuscaloosa looked up to and look to for guidance, and, you know, in these really dark times. And ultimately it had the effect of rooting Saban in the community. And, you know, I had an up-close personal look at all that. I did a SI cover story on Saban right after the tornado and the Alabama program. and, you know, was with him when he's visited all these people. And so when all these rumors would come up of Saban going to Texas or Saban going to the New York Giants, I just absolutely never bought it, because I saw that Saban and others who were there too saw it, that he was different. The tornado changed him, and it rooted him in a way in the community that he had never been rooted before. And plus, again, anything Saban wants at Alabama, he will get. And there is nothing. Alabama will spare no expense. I mean, come on, they just had Stephen A. Smith in to talk to the team, and who knows how much they paid Stephen A. to come in. You know, they just had Ray Rice come in and talk to the team about what not to do, about what he learned from his incident. You know, they have all sorts of different motivational speakers come in, and the budget at Alabama is just off the charts. You know, also when it comes to recruiting, you know, just again, no expense is too much when it comes to promoting the program. And Saban knows that he wouldn't get that kind of support, I would venture, virtually at any other school.
We're wrapping things up here with Lars Anderson. He's the New York Times bestselling author. His latest is Chasing the Bear. It's available now. He joins us courtesy of the ARCO Equipment Hotline. Lars, one final question. There was something that really caught my attention in the book that you document, which I don't think many people even remotely know about. You know, we always think of Saban. He left LSU. He wanted to be a pro coach, just like his best friend Bill Belichick. He coaches the Dolphins. It doesn't work out. And then all of a sudden, boom, he becomes the Alabama head coach, had the famous press conference where he was like, I'm not going to be the Alabama head coach, and, you know, caught a lot of hell for that. But you write in the book about how that came to be and how a construction of a lake house in Georgia is how really planted the seeds for Saban becoming the Alabama head coach. Can you detail that?
It's really funny how life works sometimes, right? Just these really strange connections. The nephew of Mal Moore sort of refurbished and rebuilt Saban's lake house in Georgia. And the nephew just marveled. And Saban was the coach at LSU at the time, and this project took a long time. And the nephew just marveled at Saban, how he worked with the workers, how he even tinkered with architectural designs. And he ultimately told Mal, he's like, this guy's Bear Bryant, who Mal Moore played for. And the nephew even mentioned to Nick, he's like, would you ever consider Alabama? And he said, you know, maybe. You know, he didn't dismiss it, and he usually dismissed everything. And so Mal had that information in the back of his mind when he got on the jet, on the Alabama jet, and flew down to South Florida. Didn't have an appointment with Saban. I mean, he'd been working back channels with Saban's agent, but he had nothing firm. He didn't have a meeting set up. But he knew from his nephew that Saban had shown just a kernel of interest. And at the time, Mal Moore's job depended on it. He was known as Malfunction Moore in the Alabama athletic department because of his bungled coaching search. You know, he thought he had Rich Rodriguez. He turned him down. Steve Spurrier turned him down. All these people were turning down this once proud program. And Moore just went all in. And really what he did is he turned on his Southern charm, and he was a charming man. He passed away, but he turned his charm on Miss Terry and selling her on life in Tuscaloosa, on how she could be a community leader in Tuscaloosa. And eventually Moore was able to talk to Nick, and he was able to convince Nick to get on the plane. And really it was Miss Terry who convinced Nick to get on the plane. And Miss Terry was the one who sort of nudged him back into college football. You know, she is his closest confidant. And I think without her and without Mal Moore's nephew, Nick Saban, and also if the Dolphins had signed Drew Brees like Saban wanted to but was overruled by his medical staff because of his throwing shoulder, sort of the recent surgery he had to his throwing shoulder, shoulder, Saban would have stayed at Miami and probably would still be there. But again, these sort of this confluence of people coming together and whispering in his ear got him to Alabama.
Lars, terrific stuff. Thoroughly enjoyed the book. I've always enjoyed all of your writing, including your book on the Mannings, which is a must-read for any fan of college football or football here in the state of Louisiana as well. Keep up the terrific work, and it was a pleasure having you on.
Thank you so much. I really appreciated this conversation.
Lars Anderson, New York Times best-selling author. His latest is Chasing the Bear. If you haven't had a chance to read his book on the Manning family, The Mannings, The Fall and Rise of a Football Family, you should get it right now. It's available in all types of different formats. It is a tremendous read. And so far, Chasing the Bear is as well. We got to take our final timeout of the day. But we'll wrap things up after this, right here on RP3 and Company, on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Tremendous show is in the books. I want to take a moment to thank all of our guests today. Lars Anderson, New York Times bestselling author, joined us. I want to thank Connor O'Gara from Saturday Down South, breaking down all things college football from week number one, also giving us a preview of week two. I want to thank Chris Blair, voice of the LSU Tigers. And I want to thank Damon Sordelet, who covers the Liberty Flames, giving us a preview of who UL faces this Saturday. Got a tremendous show lined up for you tomorrow as well. James Yasko will be on to talk Astros. Les East from Crescent City Sports talking Saints. And Tyler Nunez from Tiger Ag talking all things LSU. Y'all be safe out there. Go vote on our poll question at 1037thegame.com. You guys have a great day, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. This is Acadiana Sports Station, 1037 The Game.